Well, today we're continuing in our series on great questions in the Bible. And today we look at one that is very interesting to me. You know, whenever you hear a question in Scripture, you should just imagine that the question is also for you. And that's kind of our premise as we look at these great questions. This is a question that God asked Moses, "What do you have in your hand?" And if I were to see you walking into the service today, some of you had in your hand cell phones. Some of you had in your hand diaper bags, things, you know, gear for children. Some of you had in your hand coffee cups and things like that. And when we ask, "What do you have in your hand?" you should know that this question is for you. And so we start with the original question to Moses and a little backstory. I think you're going to like the story. I think you'll like the question that God puts in your heart when we look at this story. So you know the story, but let me just do my little, you know, running commentary, okay? So, Exodus 3, Moses led the flock to the backside of the desert. I love that terminology. That is such a colorful thing to say. That poor guy was on the backside of the desert. That's the way we would say if something was like really, really bad, right? I just feel like I live on the backside of a desert. And that's the term that God uses here in inspired Scripture. So Moses led the flock to the backside of the desert. And he came to the mountain of God. We call that Mount Horeb. We call that Mount Sinai. And so this is the burning bush, right? It's on Mount Sinai. And you know we're going to come back to Mount Sinai in the book of Exodus because it's from there that we're going to get the Ten Commandments. The burning bush and the Ten Commandments happen on the same mountain. Furthermore, we're going to visit Mount Sinai again in the book of Exodus because when Moses struck the rock and the rock gushed forth water, that was Mount Sinai. So it's all about Mount Sinai. And it begins here on the backside of the desert. He came to the mountain of God, even to Mount Horeb, Sinai. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of the bush. And the bush burned with fire, but the bush was not consumed. Here's a bush on fire, but it doesn't go away. It just keeps burning and burning and burning. And Moses is tending the flock, and the bush just keeps burning. And no bush could ever do that. If it was struck by lightning, it would burn for a few minutes and then burn itself out. And this one never does. And so in verse 4, God called to Moses out of the midst of the bush and said, "Moses," and he said, "Here I am." He said, "Do not come near here. Take off your shoes, for the place upon which you stand is holy ground." Moreover, God said, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. So this is a really emotional, dramatic experience in the burning bush. In verse 7, "And the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt, and I've heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters." When you're going through suffering, you think God doesn't hear and God doesn't care. And God is saying, "I heard when they cried, when they were in their bedrooms alone and crying on their pillows. I've been watching that. So I've heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters. For I know their sorrows, and I've come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, to bring them to a good land. And I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring forth my people out of Egypt." And Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt?" And God said, "Surely I will be with you. And when you have brought forth the people out of Egypt, then you'll serve God on this mountain. Come right back here. Where the bush was burning, you bring them back here, and you're going to serve me right here. You watch, it's going to happen." And that brings us to chapter 4 and the big question. So Moses answered, "They will not believe me or listen to my voice, for they will say, 'The Lord has not appeared to you.'" In verse 2, "And the Lord said to him, 'What is that in your hand?'" That's the question. That's where we land today. "What is that in your hand?" And Moses said, "A rod, just a normal walking stick, a staff. It's a rod." And he said, "Cast it onto the ground." And so Moses cast it on the ground. It became a serpent, evidently a cobra. Scary. By the way, if it was a long walking stick, that would be a big cobra. Cast it on the ground. He cast it on the ground. It became a serpent. And Moses fled from before it like, "Yikes, cobra." And then verse 4, "The Lord said to Moses, 'Put forth your hand and take it up by the tail.'" Steve Irwin used to do that with the snakes. Most of us grab the snake behind the ears so it can't spin around and bite us. Steve Irwin, being a disciple of Moses, evidently would always pick it up by the tail and it would try to strike, and he'd hold it away and unwind it, and if it tried to get close. So Moses had to do the Steve Irwin thing, picks it up by the tail, and why didn't it spin around and bite him? God was helping him. And verse 5, after it became a rod again, God said, we did that so that they may believe that the Lord God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob, has appeared to you. So that's it. What do you have in your hand? Oh, this old thing. It's just a walking stick. Once again, you realize God didn't ask the question because he doesn't know what's in his hand, right? It's like, I've never seen a walking stick like that. Tell me all about that. God doesn't ask the question because he doesn't know. He asks the question because he wants Moses to stop and think. And so today, we're going to stop and think. God knows what's in his hand. He wants us to think about it. So what is that in your hand? You know, that's a question. Let God ask that question to your heart right now. What is that in your hand? What do you have? And you say, well, this is just an ordinary thing. I'm an ordinary guy. I have ordinary things, you know, nothing special. Right. You mean like a walking stick. Ordinary. Especially if you're a shepherd out there on the backside of the desert. And you're going to have to, in your life, you are going to have to adequately account for the staff of God, the ordinary thing that God has put in your hand to do something with. You're going to have to come to terms with that. You're going to have to reckon with that because that's a really important thing. And we're going to talk about that in some detail. This is King Tut's burial mask. And you might not remember the details of this, but if you look right at the very front, you can see that there's a cobra. That's why you think, I wonder why God wanted this staff, this walking stick, to be turned into a snake. It's like, well, because in Egypt, snakes are just like all the rage. So King Tut is a little bit after the time of Moses. King Tut has a royal headdress, and the headdress features a cobra. Now, just so you know, this is everywhere in Egypt. Almost all the royal headdresses had a cobra because the cobra represents the goddess Wedget, who is the protector of people in this world and in the underworld when you die. That's a burial mask. And so the mask is indicating that even though King Tut has died, he wants the protection of Wedget, the goddess. And that is also sometimes referred to as the symbol Uraeus. So imagine this. Every Egyptian headdress. I mean, it's just everywhere. And statuary, including little charms that are carried by people to protect them from snake bite, yes, but from everything in the world. I mean, you just can't imagine, but I'm going to show you so you can. You can't imagine how the snake, the cobra is everything. So if we are going to send Moses to Egypt and he has a staff that turns into a snake, and when he throws it down, it's a snake, and he picks it up, that's a symbol of God taming the snake. God taming the Egyptian goddess. The Egyptian gods are no match for Moses' God. Moses, under God's supervision, can do anything he wants despite the powers of darkness in Egypt. This is a powerful illustration. Like maybe you think that your gods can protect you, but my God is the Lord of the universe, and these gods are as nothing. But it had to be that. You'll notice that King Tut's headdress, which is the normal royal headdress for centuries in Egypt, a lot of people say, well, that whole look is the look of a cobra, isn't it? Not just at the center of his mask there, but the whole hooded cobra look of the royal headdress. The Sphinx, of course, the Sphinx had his nose knocked off, poor guy. But the big Sphinx there at Tanis, Egypt by the River Nile, if you can see on the right-hand picture, there's a little mark you can still see. That is the cobra snake, Uraeus, the symbol of Wedget, the goddess of protection. The other Sphinx statue on the left is not the one in Egypt at the Nile. But this is also the normal look of the Sphinx, and you can see the protrusion there of the cobra. This is the back of King Tut's throne. And so once again, the cobra is featured prominently under the disc, which alternatively represents either the sun god, or Mars, either way. And so this is the back of his throne, the snake. It's all about the snake. This is his canopic chest. And you can see the top layer. It's the same thing as the back of the throne. Layers of cobras under the disc. And then the second layer down, same thing. Another entire line of cobras around the perimeter. The canopic chest, if you open it, inside are the jars. And in the jars, the organs of the mummy of King Tut. And so it's all about the snake. It had to be the snake. These are common ways to draw the Egyptian gods. Horus, male god, on the left, Isis, female god, on the right, and you see the disc above their heads, and surrounding the disc, the serpent. It's all about the snake. This is a painting of the Egyptian god Horus and goddess Sekhmet, alternatively called Mars and Venus, and you can see perhaps you see in the middle of them the golden sun, and the sun's rays are serpents. And you can't see it as well. You can see the discs. And because you saw the other pictures, you know what's under the discs. These are rows of serpents. It's all about the serpent. So when Moses goes to Egypt, it's all about the serpent. All right, so that gives you a little bit of background why it has to be a staff turned into a serpent. It shows God taming the gods of Egypt. What is that in your hand? And for Moses, of course, it's a stick. It's a staff. It's Moses' rod. And what is that in your hand? What do you have in your hand? Well, in your hand, you have things like cell phones, tools, a sippy cup, a coffee cup, a wallet, keys. The Lord wants to take everything that you have in your hand, your possessions, whatever you ever have in your hand. The Lord wants to take that and use it for his kingdom, for his sacred cause. And you see a thing like that cell phone there, that might not look like much to you, but you could take that cell phone and you could text somebody a message of encouragement, and they would get that message and it would mean something to them. You take that tool right there, you know, it's just a wrench. But if you have the ability to move that wrench in certain ways, you could really help somebody. You could have a real impact in somebody's life. It might not be a big impact. It might be a little impact. But you know what happens? If you keep chipping away in your life and you have many, many little impacts, then when you're done, you've really accomplished something. I see a sippy cup there with the child. You know, so what? It's just, what do you have in your hand? Baby gear. Well, it's not just baby gear, really. You know what that is? That's a sacred calling. Why, you could take a little sippy cup like that and bless a child. You could build a boy. You could build a girl with a sippy cup. So what do you have in your hand? Because maybe God would like for you to do something very special with that. What do you have in your hand? Well, I have a wallet. Well, you could take that wallet. You can do all kinds of wonderful things with that wallet. What do you have in your hand? I have a coffee cup. You know, there's probably somebody who'd really be happy to have coffee with you if you were to reach out to that person. That could really make a difference. What do you have in your hand? I have keys. Oh, yeah, keys. Like, so you own a house? Well, maybe somebody would like to come to your house someday. You could do that. Or you own a car? Well, maybe somebody would like to have a ride. Maybe you have a cool car. If you have a cool car, you know what you might do? You might use that to start conversation with somebody who otherwise wouldn't care about you. What do you have in your hand? Well, I have keys. You know, there might be something very special you could do with what you have in your hand. You see, it's really not just ordinary if God requisitions it. If it becomes a thing between you and God, then that ordinary thing becomes very, very special. And it's all about stewardship. Sometime back, Claire de Graff wrote a book called The 10-Second Rule, and I refer to this from time to time because I consider it to be a very important idea. In his book, The 10-Second Rule, he says, sometimes you're going along in life, and the Lord gives you an impression that maybe you ought to do something. And a lot of times you have like 10 seconds before you talk yourself out of it. And so maybe you shouldn't talk yourself out of it. Maybe if the idea comes to you when you have your cell phone that I could make a text message here to somebody who might appreciate it, maybe you shouldn't talk yourself out of it. Why don't you just hurry up? If you're relatively sure that that's something nice that Christ might want you to do, why don't you just hurry up and do it before you talk yourself out of it? And the same thing with any of these devices. You know, I could invite somebody to a cup of coffee. I could drive my car just a little out of the way here and stop off and help somebody. I could. And so in the 10-second rule, that's what Claire de Graaff does. He says, years ago, I began to notice that I would often feel an impulse to do something good, to help someone, to visit someone, to talk to a coworker about Jesus. And I say, I will, but then I don't. And sometimes I would act on these impulses, but far too often I wouldn't. Why? Because just about the time I heard that first voice, that inner urging, I heard another voice. It said, well, you'll be late, or helping him could get messy, or you'll just embarrass them, or I'm sure that need will be met by someone else. So if the little debate going on in my heart and mind lasts long enough, the impulse to obey the first voice fades away. Life moves on, comfortable and predictable. So he said he changed. And now when he has thoughts like that, particularly calling somebody on the phone, he says it's become habitual. God would bring names to my mind, and I would call, meet them for lunch, and share the spiritual journey I was on. Then I would listen to see how they responded. Did it always go well? No. I'm sure some men thought I lost my mind. But I began losing my fear because I'm doing what I'm reasonably certain Jesus wants me to do. What is there to fear? I felt like I was flying without a net and loving it. So sometimes the Lord says, well, what do you have in your hand? Like, oh, nothing, you know, cell phone. Yeah, well, why don't you do something with that? You could do something with it. What do you have in your hand? Well, keys. I have a wrench. I have baby gear. Well, why don't you do something with that for me? That might have cosmic importance. Claire de Graaff tells the story about this lady in a grocery store, a Christian lady. She's looking at the lady in front of her, and the lady in front of her has this meltdown. She has one unruly child who has disappeared in the store somewhere, another one clinging to her leg and crying about something, and she's paying for her stuff, and she realizes she can't find, her credit card is declined, so she's trying to find enough cash, and she can't find enough cash. She has half her purse dumped out in front of the cashier, and she looks like she's going to cry. So this Christian lady is standing back there watching this, and she hands her credit card to the cashier and says, I think this will take care of it. And of course, the first lady is mortified. You don't have to do that for me. And she says, no, I want to do it. When everything is paid for, the lady who was so frazzled said, why'd you do that for me? And she said, I don't know, I'm a Christian. The thought just came to my mind that I should help you. So if you want to thank God for what happened here, you know, you go ahead and do that. Simple, right? Except what has happened is, you know, what do you have in your hand? I have a credit card. Well, you know, you could do something fine with that. And so what we're trying to teach here is that that ordinary thing in your hand isn't really for you, it's for God and for others, and the Lord just lets it pass through your hand so you can do great stuff. You have to adequately account for the ordinary thing in your hand that becomes the staff of God, the rod of God. It's not ordinary if you use it for Jesus. It becomes special, and that's exactly what he wants you to do. So it's a sacred possession of God. Now I'm just going to toggle back and forth through some of these ideas about the staff of God. And I want you to see that the Bible doesn't exactly tell us whose staff this is, which is really wonderful. So watch what happens. In Exodus 4:17, you know, which is where we started, burning bush, what do you have in your hand? It's a staff. And so in verse 17, you'll take this rod in your hand with which you shall do signs, And the Lord said to Moses in Midian, go, return to Egypt, for all the men are dead which sought your life. And Moses returned to the land of Egypt, and Moses took the rod of God in his hand. So see what's happened? It's gone from being Moses' staff. What do you have in your hand, Moses? Just a stick. Throw it down. Now it has become the rod of God. So what do you have in your hand? What is your stuff? The Lord wants that stuff. And it's now going to be the cell phone of God. This is the sippy cup of God. This is the coffee cup of God. These are the keys of God. These are the possessions of God that I have some stewardship over. In chapter 17, verse 9, Moses said to Joshua, I have to go fight Amalek. Choose out men, go out, fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand. It's God's, really. And it's not Moses. It's not Aaron's. It's not Moses and Aaron's together, really. It's not the Israelites' rod of God, really, the national rod that we all own. It's really God's. But watch what happens. Exodus 4:2, what do you have in your hand? A rod. Exodus 4:20, so Moses took his wife's sons, took the rod of God in his hand. Now watch how this is in chapter 7. This isn't Moses' rod. This is Aaron's rod. Like, well, which is it, Moses or Aaron? Does it really matter? Exodus 7:8. The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron. You shall say to Aaron, take your rod. Like, hey, that was my rod. Remember when you asked me, what do you have in your hand? No, you say to Aaron, Aaron, take your rod. Cast it before Pharaoh. It shall become a serpent. And Aaron cast down his rod, Aaron's rod, before Pharaoh. And in verse 14, and the Lord said to Moses, get to Pharaoh in the morning, and the rod that was turned to a serpent, you shall take in your hand, Moses. Okay, so it's Moses' rod. I got it. And then say to Aaron, Aaron, take your rod. Take your rod, stretch it out on the waters of Egypt, and they become blood. So it's Moses, it's Aaron's, neither. In verse 5 of chapter 8, it's Aaron's, right? The Lord spoke to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch forth your hand with your rod over the streams, over the rivers, over the ponds, and cause frogs to come up upon the land of Egypt. So the plague of frogs comes from Aaron's rod. Well, same in verse 16. The Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your rod, strike the dust of the land, that it may become lice throughout all the land of Egypt. They did so, for Aaron stretched out his hand with his rod and struck the dust of the earth. But now watch, it goes back to Moses. And the Lord said to Moses, stretch forth your hand toward heaven, that there may be hail in all the land of Egypt. And Moses stretched forth his rod toward heaven, and the Lord sent thunder and hail. So it's back to Moses. In chapter 10, verse 12, and the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the land of Egypt for the locusts, that they may come up on the land of Egypt. And Moses stretched forth his rod. So it's his, it's Aaron's. And back and forth we go. Chapter 14, verse 16, the Lord says to Moses, lift up your rod and divide the Red Sea. In chapter 17, the Lord said to Moses, go on before the people, take with you of the elders of Israel and your rod that you use when you struck the river. It's like, hey, Aaron struck the river. Yeah, well, you know, you did it together and the rod goes back and forth. And you shall strike the rock and there shall come water out of it. And so Moses did that. He took his staff to do that. Chapter 17, verse 9. Moses said, I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God. Oh, so it's Moses' rod. It's Aaron's rod. It's God's. It's really God's. And so they defeat the Amalekites. In Numbers chapter 20, verse 7, this is the second time water comes out of the rock. The Lord spoke to Moses, take the rod. Doesn't really matter if it's your staff, Aaron's staff, or my staff. It's really all mine, right? Take the rod, speak to the rock before their eyes, it shall give forth his water. So Moses took the rod, which has now been stowed away carefully in the tabernacle because it's like a very special symbol. So Moses took the rod from before the Lord meaning in the tabernacle, took the rod from before the Lord, lifted up his hand, and with his rod, it's Moses' rod again, the rod of God, it's his rod, it's Aaron's rod, it's always God's. So what you're holding in your hand is actually God's. You could call it yours if you want to. Or you could call it errands if you want to. It really makes no difference. It's God's stuff. And once you get that, like this thing that I have here, you know, let us say I have a swimming pool. This is God's swimming pool. I have a car with a flat tire. Like, God, your car has a flat tire. I hope you have some financial wherewithal to fix your car's flat tire. It's all God's. And God wants you to use it in His way, and He'll give you the ability to use it in His way. It's all God's. And you have to realize that that thing that you have in your hand is an instrument that can give lift and life. And that's what God wants you to do. I sometimes like to tell you that the Bible heroes, the apostles, what they get in armloads, we get in handfuls. So, you know, sure, Moses is special, of course. And what he has in his hand is going to do miraculous things. And you probably don't have anything quite like that. And that's okay. What Moses had in armloads, you have in handfuls. So, you know, you imagine somebody bringing groceries into the house from the store, and let's imagine that they are in those brown paper bags, and you grab a whole bunch of those brown paper bags, and you hug them, and you begin to walk toward the house. So you have groceries in armloads. And another guy, he has his hand out, and he's carrying, like, so, you know, what groceries do you have in your one hand? I have 3 apples. All right. Well, you know, that's not an armload, but 3 apples, that's also not nothing, right? I mean, it's kind of great. What if it's clothing? Well, I'm cleaning out my closets or I'm doing laundry and I have this much clothing, you know, armloads of clothing. And then somebody else has a handful. Like, what do you have in your hand? What clothes do you have in your hand? Well, in my hand, I have blue jeans and a T-shirt. Well, that's not exactly an armload. Well, blue jeans and a T-shirt, that's not exactly nothing either, right? I mean, it's pretty great. So you say, well, I'm no Moses. Right. Well, nobody is saying it's right. And my staff is a cell phone. I don't think that's comparable. Maybe. But what Moses had in armloads, you have in handfuls. And that's not nothing. So you have to come to terms with the stewardship that you've been given. God has these possessions that you sort of manage for Him. And He wants you to do something great with them. And they might become instruments of life and lift, which is, you know, very wonderful when that happens. A girl named Maggie was at a university in Oregon. And, you know, this impulse comes to her. Like, I kind of feel like in my dorm, co-ed dorm, I would like to just set out a bunch of ice cream and invite everybody. If you want to come by for ice cream, then, you know, I'm going to have a spread. So she says, you know, she wants to do that. It's kind of a weird idea, in some ways a dumb idea. And she prays and said, Lord, I don't know. Am I just like going off half-cocked here? I don't know. And so she has the ice cream. And all the college students from the dorm descend on her room like locusts and devour the ice cream and walk away. And when it's all done, she thought, what was that? And she told her friends, I guess it was just a dumb idea. I don't know. The next day, 8 students walked up to her, thanked her for the ice cream and said, you know, it gave me the impression that you just care about us. Like, yeah, that's what was supposed to happen there. So you say, well, what do you have in your hand? Well, me, I have 3 gallons of ice cream. Good. Now, the Lord's going to take that 3 gallons and He's going to do magic with it. And He does those things because really it's His ice cream, right? It's His money that paid for the ice cream. So you just have to realize that the Lord has plans for your stuff. You say, but that is ordinary. And so it is. But ordinary is good. It's God's stuff, and it can be good. So Debbie Basden says, let's start with laundry angst. What if that pile of laundry is a gift in disguise from a God you can't yet see? Now, hear me out on this one. I was an assertive, badgering wife until my husband died. The day my husband left earth for heaven, all of my marriage problems vanished. Marriage is designed to be a reflection of Christ's love for his people. Days after his funeral, I stared at our dirty clothes basket that sat atop our dryer, knowing his clothes were inside. And I sighed so deeply. Before me was the last load of laundry I would ever wash for that sweet man. There'd be no more dirty socks to pick up around the house, ever. A week before, I would have rolled my eyes at that basket, but now it held priceless treasures. I waited weeks to wash those clothes. My heart ached for dirty socks to once more be a part of my days. We have the opportunity to demonstrate love by serving those we live with. Those clothes were painfully cleaned and boxed away or donated. The tears, countless. And God, the lover of my soul, in his infinite mercy, later gave me a special gift. He has allowed me to love again, to wear a second wedding dress, and to be a better wife. I married a wonderful man. I'm working on edifying the man who provides my sons and me a nice living. I now strive to hug more and nag less. My goal is to make him feel respected, important, valued. I want to live love. You know, that laundry basket. You know, what do you have in your hand? Laundry. Yes, you see what that is, though? That's actually God's laundry. And it's for you to appreciate. It's for you to use to build people, in this case, perhaps your spouse or your kids. And that's not nothing. Say, well, it's not like stretching your staff, your magic wand, over the river and turning it into blood. Maybe. But it's also not nothing. And the Lord says, what's in your hand? Because I want to set that aside for something very special. I want you to make a dent in this world for good. And you can do that. Some years back, Dorothy is making Thanksgiving dinner. She's rushing into the grocery store. She knows right where to go. She needs one more can of cranberries for Thanksgiving dinner tomorrow. She goes to the store. She goes to the right shelf. And she's just about to lean forward and get it. And all of a sudden, shoop, somebody else grabbed it. And when the somebody else realized that Dorothy wanted it, then, you know, they had an argument there. No, you take it. No, you take it. No, you take it. And the employee nearby says, we have more in the back. Give me a second. I'll go get it. So Dorothy and Betty are sitting there just getting acquainted, waiting for this other can of cranberries. And it turns out Betty hasn't even lived in that area for very long. And so they changed recipes there and they're talking. And after the holidays, they got together once. And one day, Betty's husband came over to Dorothy's house and said, you know, we're new to this area and my wife just is having a little bit of a hard time making friends. And so we really appreciate your friendship. And so Dorothy decided to invite Betty to a Bible study. And Betty was glad to go to meet more people. And then Dorothy was embarrassed because, as it turns out, that particular day, she had another Bible study that she was supposed to go to in another place. And she couldn't bring herself to ask Betty to come to a second Bible study. But Betty was having a good time, so she said, I'll go. So she went to the second Bible study, and she became a Christian there. And a short time later, so did her husband and her children. And it's like God would say, so what do you have in your hand there, Dorothy? Cranberries? You know, I want to do magic with that. I want that to be a lift. So that's the way it turned out. And so many things are like that in life. So it becomes a lift. Big things, little things. Certain things you can't do. So, for example, we love to tell that story. Dallas Seminary, founded in 1924. They're on the ropes. A bill has come due for their rent of the building, of the seminary building, and they can't pay it. They just don't have any money, and they're going to be foreclosed on at noon. So all the bigwigs have this prayer meeting, and they are praying that the Lord would send help before noon. while they're praying, the secretary's on the outside there at the desk, the receptionist desk. And this cattle guy, I mean, it is Dallas Seminary, right? So this cattle guy walks in and says, listen, I just sold a train car load of cattle, and I was supposed to flip this and make this business thing happen, and it didn't work out. And I just got the impression that the Lord was supposed to give you, the seminary, this money that I profited from the cattle. So I don't know what your situation is, but I think I'm supposed to give this to you. And they're in the room next door praying that they won't be foreclosed on at noon. What's in your hand? Cattle, or a check from cattle. I want that. I want to do magic with that. I want to lift the world with that. And maybe you can't do that. So, you know, let's just step it down. Maybe you can't do that. You're not a cattle guy, but there might be some other things you can do. So, for example, John Maxwell is flying, because he always flies from conference to conference, Christian leadership conferences, and he goes to the gate where his plane is supposed to be ready, and there are 50 or 60 people in the gate, and they're all grouchy because the plane is delayed. The plane is delayed because the flight attendants are on another flight, and they haven't gotten there yet, and they're supposed to, you know, get out there, and nothing's happening. So 50 or 60 people a little bit perturbed. And John Maxwell's like the ultimate extrovert. And so he sees what's going on, and he goes over to the food court area there, and he says, I'd like to have 60 Cokes. And he says, you want 60 Cokes? He said, yeah, all of my fellow passengers over there are feeling terrible, and I just thought I'd like to buy them all a Coke. And so he went over there, and he bought everybody a Coke, and at first they're like, you're weird. Is there anything wrong here? Then eventually he just talks to them a little bit, and they've had their Coke. And when it's all done, they clapped for him. Well, everybody knows that John Maxwell is a Christian, so he basically is making friends for Jesus. Are Christians, you know, magnanimous? Are Christians generous? Well, that sort of just settles that, right? Say, well, I don't have enough money for 50 or 60 Cokes. Fine, you know, whatever. Let's just keep going. So let's say you don't. Let's walk it back. Johnny Erickson, Tara, talks about when she was a little girl, her dad took her camping, which meant so much to her. And they went along the Chesapeake Bay. You know where that is. And they went camping, and he would tell them stories, and then they would sing hymns. And here's what she said about those camping trips. And about her dad. She said, I couldn't imagine a kid anywhere else on the planet that night, much less among the sand dunes of the Delaware coast, who felt as safe as I felt. Part of that feeling was the stories, part of it the hymns. What do you have in your hand? I have a tent. Good. I want to do magic with that. What do you have in your hand? I could, like, take my hat and twist it goofy and tell my kids a story. Good. Why don't you just do that? I want your hat. I want to do magic. I want to lift the children. I want to secure their little souls. And today you're going to do that. I think it's just ordinary stuff, you know, camping gear, hat, silly. It's ordinary. I want you to take the ordinary thing. I want you to give it to me, and I want to do magic with it, and we're going to do this. And that's not going to be your camping gear. That's my camping gear. It's not your hat. It's my hat. It's not your cranberries. They're my cranberries, and you just have to give them to me, and we're going to always think about how we can do magic. We're going to lift people with these things. And you say, well, I don't have the opportunity to go camping anymore. All right, what is your thing? What do you have in your hand? I have a diaper. Diapering a baby is an eternal act that looks temporary. In that moment when a parent is leaning over her baby and their eyes lock in a steady gaze, true bonding occurs. Parent bonding doesn't spring up over scheduled 15-minute intervals. It happens at 2 o'clock in the morning when your eyes are bloodshot and feel like they're full of gravel. In those unplanned moments, heaven hushes while a parent and child are suspended in a loving eye-to-eye embrace. It didn't feel eternal when you crawled out of bed, but it was. So what do you have in your hand? Nothing. There's something in your hand. What is that? It's a diaper. Good. I want you to do magic with that. I want to take that and I want you to build a boy, build a girl. I want you to secure their souls. That's mine. All that stuff is mine. And what you have in your hand is a stewardship. I'm letting you manage this little corner of my estate. And I want you to make the garden grow. And I want you to make all the people happy. And that's your business. And I'll give you the stuff to do it. And always you just be thinking, what would a God like my God want a guy like me to be doing with stuff like this that I hold in my hand every day? See, that's it. And imagine when, after a while, Moses or Aaron start walking toward the Egyptians with that staff. Imagine how exciting that must have been for the Israelites. Like, good news, here comes Moses, and guess what he has in his hand? This is going to be so great. A stick. And yet it's become God's stick. And what's better than that? And so what you're holding in your hand, that's for divine lift right there. And it's also for a weapon to subdue darkness, which is related to a divine lift. There's not much difference. But just remember what that staff must have meant to the Egyptian people. Every time Moses or Aaron approached with the staff, the Israelites say, yay, help us on the way. And every time they approach with the staff, the Egyptians say, oh, no, they're back. And that's what you are doing with the stuff God gives you. In Aaron's hand, the staff brought the plague of blood, the plague of frogs, and the plague of lice. In Moses' hand, the staff brought the plague of fiery hail and locusts. It also parted the Red Sea and closed the Red Sea and drowned the enemies. And in the Amalekite War, when the staff was lifted, the Amalekites were defeated in battle. And so for one group, the staff was such a lift. And for another group, it was like, oh no, this thing's a weapon. And that's what you have in your hand. You have a weapon. And that weapon is what the Lord wants you to use to take care of people. So it can come in so many ways, right? You remember the story of Mario. He is a hardcore communist in South America. And Jim Peterson is a missionary. And Jim Peterson is reaching out to Mario. And there's this story about ordinary things. So Mario is now interested in the gospel and he wants to be a Christian. So Jim, the missionary, says, Mario, you know, what tipped the scales? Why did you want to become a Christian? And Mario says, you remember the first time I stopped by your house? We were on our way someplace together. And I had a bowl of soup with you and your family. See, that's ordinary. What do you have in your hand? Bowl of soup? Great. I want to use that to do magic. So we were on our way someplace together, and I had a bowl of soup with you and your family. And as I sat there observing you, your wife, your children, and how you related to each other, I asked myself, when will I have a relationship like this with my fiancé? When I realized the answer was never, I concluded that I had to become a Christian for the sake of my own survival. What do you have in your hand? Bowl of soup. You might have a bowl of soup? See, that's God's stuff. And it's for a lift and it's for a weapon. So that bowl of soup, it becomes an attack on the devil. It says, no, there's one you'll never get. All of that from a bowl of soup. And that's what the Lord is doing. I love reading the story of Kim Meter. She started a ranch in Oregon, and it was a terrible place. It was all dug out from strip mining, and so they just told everybody around, if you have anything to fill in this horrific pit, we'll throw it in the hole. So they just brought everything. You know, I have gravel, I have rocks, I have whatever, throw it in there. And eventually they leveled it out and became a usable property. And they brought some horses there, particularly they're rescuing cheap horses. What do you have in your hand? A broken horse. Good. I want to do magic with that. So one day she has a very troubled girl there. This girl has been cutting herself deeply. When she comes to the ranch, she still has some bright red cuts. They're not very old. And she says, there's this, always this voice in the back of her head that says, someday you should just finish it. Finish it. You know, cut deeply enough to die. And she thought she probably would do that someday. And then she comes to the horse ranch because she's kind of desperate. And so Kim is eating with her. News comes, there's a ranch down the way. And these horses are basically starved to death. Somebody should go help. So Kim and this young girl go visit this property. And sure enough, there's a horse there named Solstice. They said what it looked like was an old boot with the skin hanging from it. It was just starved. And more lice than she'd ever seen on an animal before. It was just horrifically sad. And so they made arrangements with the owner to buy this horse, Solstice. And they took it back home. And this young girl was fascinated with the horse. They brought it there, and the horse was so exhausted. First they fed the horse, and then the horse was so exhausted, it lay right down there. It was a snowy day. Lay right down there on the ground. And just had no strength. Well, this young girl felt so sorry for the horse that she went over and she lay down right next to the horse and kind of snuggled up against it so that she was right up against the horse's back on her side, the horse on its side, and petting the horse. And pretty soon the horse just fell asleep. It was so sick and exhausted. And this young girl realized at some point that the horse was dreaming, because when horses dream, they kind of have like little seizures, you know, quivering. And she said in that moment that she realized that this horse, this young horse who'd been through so much, still had dreams. And if the horse who'd been through so much could still have dreams, then maybe she could have dreams too. And later when she was talking to Kim about this, here's what she said. The clenched fists inside my heart began to slowly open up to God, who was calling me to safety and freedom and release and love. What do you have in your hand? A very sick horse. Good. I want to do magic with that. And so the weapon subdues darkness. The weapon, you mean a cell phone, a sippy cup, a coffee cup, keys? Yep, that's what subdues the darkness. So sacred possibilities, ordinary possessions become sacred. They become extraordinary, having cosmic importance, because it lifts a person, a boy or girl perhaps, who needs to have their little soul secured. It lifts a young man or woman, or an older man or woman who just need a break. And a weapon, like there's one that the devil will never get. Look at, I just wrecked one of the devil's traps with this old broken down horse. He had it all figured out, and now he doesn't. That's it, a weapon to subdue the darkness. And that's why when the Lord asked Moses, what is that in your hand? Is asking a very important question. I'd like for you to bow your heads and close your eyes. I would just like for you to answer the question in your own heart. What do you have in your hand? Have you given it to the Lord? Have you said, you know, I just want to open myself up. If there's anything I have today, I just want you to know. I want you to do the magic with it. So you answer the question in your own heart.